Welcome, everyone. This is Beverly Tomasian. I'm so excited to be sharing this webcast for you on preparing for the CDE exam. Becoming a diabetes educator is so terrific. I've been a diabetes educator for over 20 years, and I've taken the exam and successfully passed it 5 times. I'm getting ready to take it my 6th time, and you may ask, well, why does she keep taking the exam if you can just renew by CEs? Well, I keep taking the exam because I want to know what's on the exam, because one of my main part of my business is helping healthcare professionals move toward becoming diabetes educators. That's really such an important part of the vision of my business, and it's such a delight for me to meet all of you, to share this information with you, to be a resource, because certainly we have an epidemic of diabetes on our hands, and the more diabetes educators we have to really battle this, and not only battle diabetes, but pre-diabetes, it's going to be really helpful and helpful both for our communities and, you know, for our children growing up. I mean, we have so many environmental issues going on. I think that we need to look at this from a big picture and say, how can we improve the health of our children and generations to come? And certainly with more information, becoming a certified diabetes educator, it just says that we've really committed to learn about this disease and to help identify who has it and help people at risk for getting it, not get it, and then help people who do have it live successfully and healthfully. So thank you so much for joining this webcast today. I'm very excited, and I hope you had a chance to download the handouts. They're on the resource page with all our other preparing for CDE exam information. You can download them there, or I sent an email out, and you could click on those links. We have about an hour, and I say an hour and 10 minutes, so I'll try and get all the content in an hour, and then I'll stay for any additional questions. I know it's Monday, and you have a lot on your plate, so I really want to be sensitive to your time. We're going to talk about the eligibility requirements, updates on the exam, and how to get ready for success. And throughout this webcast, I put pictures of flowers. And the reason I put pictures of flowers is because taking a test can be very anxiety-producing, especially for adults. We haven't taken a test maybe for years. We graduated 30 years ago from nursing school, for example, and we haven't taken exams. And so I want to really help us focus on the process of taking the exam. And there is an enjoyable aspect. You get to learn more. You get to become a better diabetes educator. You get to increase your wealth of diabetes knowledge. It's really an enjoyable process if you look at it from that. And when you're feeling anxious, I want you to start thinking about something that can calm you down. And for me, flowers, pictures of flowers, or just moving, you know, I like moving calms me down. Whatever calms you down, go to that direction, because we really want to feel calm and present as we study for the exam and as we take the exam. So today we're going to be talking about eligibility. What is a diabetes educator? How do we define that? It's a very important definition because it's going to help give us a philosophical underpinning for the exam. We'll talk about what's on the exam, how to study. We'll do test-taking tips and resources. So we have a lot to cover on this webcast. I do want to say that I have no relationship with the National Credentialing Board of Diabetes Educators. They are the organization in charge of providing the exam and grading the exam. And so I have no insider information. I don't ask them particular questions. They don't give me any answers. I am just like you. I go to their website. I listen to what they have to say. I read their brochures and their catalog. So that's the way I get my information. Plus, just taking the exam every 5 years really helps too. Before I go on to this, what I would like to do is launch a poll question. Since I don't get to see all of you out there, I want to just ask a few questions, and all you need to do is choose the right answer on your screen. When are you planning to take the CDE exam? Spring 2015 or fall 2015? Maybe you're not going to take it till spring 2016. Well, maybe in the next few years. And E, you're not really sure. You're just kind of checking it out and seeing, you know, should I really take this exam? All right, thanks for voting, everyone. All right, take one more second to vote, and I'm going to go ahead and close this and share it with you. So 53% of you said, I'm going to take it in the spring. Okay, so you're looking at taking this exam pretty soon. 22% in the fall, so about 75% of you this year. Next year, we have 10% taking it in the spring, and about 15% of you not really sure when you're going to be taking that. Okay, well, thank you so much for sharing that. It really helps me to hone in on what we're going to be talking about. Okay, I'm just looking at some questions people were posting. So it looks like we're okay. I'm going to go ahead and hide this. And I just want to say then most of us are taking it pretty quickly. So I'm going to focus more on preparing for the exam. For those of you who are taking it or thinking about taking it, I'll be providing some additional information on eligibility too. Let me just do another poll here. Which content area would you like me to focus on most during this webcast? And you can choose more than a one answer. Do you want me to talk about eligibility to take the exam? What is on it? Test taking strategies, sample test questions, or just cover everything. We want to know about everything regarding this exam. Okay. Let me go ahead and share this answer with all of you. You all have voted. Well, most 93% of you voted. So 6% of you want to know eligibility. So it sounds like that's not the big focus here, but what is on it? Test taking strategies, sample test questions are the big thing that people want to hear about. And 40% of you said, let's hear about all of it. Okay. Well, I'll try and accomplish that and cover the most critical aspects. So let's keep going. Wait, I think I have one more poll question. Well, I'm going to wait for that poll question. That's what I'm going to do. And then we'll come back to that. So why take the CDE exam? So some of you are not really decided, and this applies to all of us really. Why would we study so hard to take this 200-question exam to become certified diabetes educators? Well, it demonstrates to people with diabetes, employers, and third-party payers that we have distinct and specialized knowledge in a field, that we've studied really hard to learn about diabetes in a wide breadth of areas, and thereby we can promote the best quality of care for our patients with diabetes. And CDE is a recognized standard. It's been around for a long time, and employers have heard of it, patients have heard of it. It's a well-recognized certification. And so I think it's really valued in that way from an employer and a patient standpoint. And like I said earlier, given this epidemic of diabetes, we really do need CDEs. And so what is a CDE? And this is important if you're taking the exam. You need to know how it's defined. What is a CDE? What is our scope of practice? Because exam is going to ask you questions, and you're going to need to really focus in on what would a CDE do at this point. So you want to not come from a medical model. You want to come more for a diabetes educator model when looking at the questions. So a CDE is a healthcare professional with comprehensive knowledge and experience in diabetes management, pre-diabetes management, so we need to know not only about diabetes, but pre-diabetes and prevention. So we need to know about all of those. Look at this. We educate and support people with diabetes to understand and manage the condition. So we're going to be sharing information with people so they understand what diabetes is and how they can successfully manage it. Diabetes is a self-managed condition. We can't be there with them 24/7, so we need to give them a lot of tools. And that's what this next bullet point says. Promote self-management to achieve individualized behavioral and treatment goals. Okay, behavioral, very important. Our number one job is to help people make those behavior changes to improve outcomes. And by doing the changes in their behavior, they reach their treatment goals. So we need to know what are the treatment goals because ultimately, we're trying to help improve health outcomes. We can't get everybody to perfect, obviously, and only people can move themselves to perfect. But we're going to try and support people on their journey to succeed. So who is qualified to take the exam? And I'll just spend a few minutes on professional qualifications, but I've listed the different licensures that can take the exam here, and you can see where you lie in this list. And in addition to having your professional licensure, you need a minimum of 2 years of professional practice experience And so you need to be practicing for 2 years with your licensure and also accumulate 1,000 hours of diabetes self-management education. And this has to be in the past 4 years with 40% in the preceding year of applying to take the exam. And you need 15 clock hours of CE education within 2 years prior to applying for the exam. So those are all of the minimal requirements you need to apply and take the exam. And this is right from the NCBDE handbook. So I have a link to the handbook on my website. You can check it out too. But this is, if you can answer all of these questions and say yes, you are ready to take the exam. So this is a really nice checklist. I just copied and pasted right from their CDE handbook. New for health educators, this is exciting. If you have a master's in health education and you're a certified health education specialist, you have that credential, plus you meet all of the NCBDE eligibility requirements, you can also sit for the exam. So that's new. So if you have your CHESS, you can sit for the CDE exam. And there is a new unique qualifications pathway designed for health professionals who hold an advanced degree in a health-related area or concentration. That's not that typical licensure I pointed out a few slides ago. So the pathway has different eligibility requirements, and they require a pre-application plus 2,000 hours of diabetes self-management experience. So if you're in that category, you might want to contact and look at the NCBDE website early on. So only experience completed after earning your professional degree can be counted. So if I get my RN, I can't count any hours doing diabetes self-management education before I actually get my licensure. It has to be after my licensure, and I need 1,000 hours of DSME practice hours. So that's just a caveat that you have to get your license first. And new is that you can get your practice hours through volunteering. This was never happening. About 2 years ago, this was not the case. So finally, they started saying, yes, volunteer hours do count. So this is exciting, but your supervisor must attest that the DSME provided meets the criteria. And I'll be showing what the criteria is in a minute for diabetes self-management education, what hours count. There are some activities that don't count towards your practice hours, and these are just some that I've listed here. Supervising and managing professionals, providing medical assessment. So this, you have to provide diabetes self-management education. It's not medical assessment. Dispensing or prescribing medications does not count. Promoting or selling medications, diabetes supplies or products. So these are all other activities that can't count in your 1,000 hours of diabetes self-management education hours. Okay, another very important definition. Diabetes self-management education, we have to be a health professional with appropriate credentials. It involves people with prediabetes or diabetes caregivers and educators, and it is defined as an ongoing process. It's not just a once and you're done. It's an ongoing process of facilitating knowledge, skills, and ability necessary for self-care. And so this self-care keeps coming up and up. It comes up a lot. And we want to facilitate their knowledge of self-care. So this is very important. Diabetes, as I've mentioned, is a self-managed condition. DSME, this is a continued definition. This is really an important concept to know because on the exam, they're going to be asking you questions kind of getting towards your scope of practice and what we do, and we want to be familiar with this concept. It is a concept of comprehensive plan of, it is a component of comprehensive plan of diabetes care. Diabetes self-management, we want to really help make a plan to help that person be as independent and provide self-care as much as possible. Look at this. It incorporates the needs, goals, and life experiences of the person who comes to see us. And it's guided by evidence-based standards. Okay, this is very important because we have to individualize the education we provide to patients. We have to find out about their needs, their goals, life experiences. So during our assessment, we're going to be asking really important questions. And then we take that information and we look at evidence-based standards. What does the research say? And so we look at the individual patients plus the research. We put that together and help the patient develop a plan. Its goal is to support informed decision-making, self-care behaviors, problem-solving, and active collaboration with the healthcare team. Collaboration, another important word. We cannot do it all by ourselves. We need the support of the team. So we're going to refer out to our colleagues to help improve outcomes. Diabetes self-management experience, defined for practice experience. A lot of people ask me, what counts as my hours? It means that you're doing diabetes self-management education, and it's defined as assessment and education plan developed by the individual and educator to help direct educational interventions and self-management support strategy. So this is what DSME is. We assess and we develop an education plan. We provide educational interventions to help the individual meet their self-management goals. And then we do periodic evaluations to determine were these goals met. We create a personalized follow-up plan. This is really important because it's not just a one-time shot. We need to develop a plan how we're going to follow up with that patient. Medicare requires that, and is part of our ADA recognition or any recognized program. How are we going to make sure this patient is receiving the follow-up care and support they need to succeed? And that could be through support groups, through yearly phone calls, through mail correspondence, but we need to keep a check-in with our people. Documentation, very important, and are we sharing what we're doing with the referring providers and having good open communication? And also included in DSME is program development and administration to support diabetes patient education. So if you're setting up a diabetes management program, those hours do count toward your 1,000 hours. Okay. So applying to take the CDE exam, at the time of your online application, you will receive a notice of either approval or that you have been selected for an audit. You can also apply by paper, but paper you want to check in within 4 weeks to make sure they received your application. But let me just follow up on this audit note. If you are requested to send in some paperwork, they'll ask for your licensure, your documentation of professional practice experience. So how do you document your hours of professional practice? Just keep a journal of your weekly hours. So you just every week write down how many hours you were involved in providing diabetes self-management education. And you'll just need a supervisor to sign off on that if you're audited and they ask you to send it in. So make sure your supervisor knows you're working on this and that you want to apply for your CDE and they can verify your hours. You'll need CE course verification, you'll need to send in your certificate, and then, of course, employment verification signed by your supervisor. Not everyone is audited, but if you are, this is what they're going to ask for. The test is computerized, which is really exciting for those of us who remember the paper and pencil Scantron test. And you can see here the window to apply for spring is January through March, and window to apply for fall, July through September. So these are just kind of the test windows so you know when to plan, when to apply, and when you'll actually be taking your test. Once you receive eligibility confirmation, and then you have to go to CASEL's online scheduling system to sign up for the exam. Now, when will you get the results? Well, you're going to get the results for your test the same day. So after you take your test, in the computer, in the lab, it's not really a lab, it's just a computer test location site, you go to the proctor and they'll give you your test result right then and there. And you can retake the test as many times as you need to. It's expensive to retake. The first time you take it, it's $350. Renewal is $250. But you can there is no limit on how many times you can retake the exam. As far as scoring the exam, the total score determines pass-fail and is reported as a scaled score. So each question is not worth 1 point. Some questions which are more difficult might be worth 3 points. Easier questions might be worth 1 point. So it's called a scaled score, and so that way it's fair for everyone taking the exam. And to pass, you need 70 scaled score units. Mm-hmm. That's passing. Now, you might be interested in the CDE pass rates over time. And in 2006, the pass rates were about 80%. And then you can see, starting in 2009, once the test became computerized, I'm not sure what else happened there, but the test pass rates went down a bit. And right around 2013, there's no more current pass rates that I could find. They're running about 67% to 70%. And so you can see the pass rate's about 70%. So I'm going to tell you the truth. This is not an easy exam. It does require studying. It does require review. It does require that you really focus on content you're least familiar with. And so it's going to help you grow as an educator. That's all I could tell you. Just from me taking the exam, you know, as many times as I have, it's improved my knowledge because I have to keep up to date with all the diabetes changes that are out there. And so kind of put a positive spin on it that most people pass this exam, but in order to pass, I'm going to really have to focus my study time and prepare in every way I can. I'm going to give you some strategies on preparing too. It's a 200 multiple choice objective questions, and you have 4 hours to answer the questions. So 200 multiple choice questions. It's based on a job analysis completed in 2013, which surveyed educators about the tasks they performed. So they definitely want to know what tasks do diabetes educators do, and how do we associate that task with knowledge. And so it's kind of this pairing of your knowledge of the evidence-based diabetes information plus the task involved with implementing that knowledge, which will give you some sample questions. So here I go again. Questions are linked directly to a task or task. Each question is designed to test, does a candidate possess the knowledge necessary to perform the task? Or do you have the ability to apply your knowledge in a job setting? So they're going to give you a ton of case scenarios, case studies, vignettes. They're going to give you a lot of information about the patient that you have to sort through. So be ready for very wordy questions, and then you're going to try and drill down to the most important concept in that question. 25 of the 200 questions are new, but are not counted in the determination of examination scores. What does that mean? Well, it means that 25 of the 200 questions, they're just testing out to see how well they're written. So they're not really counted in your score. So if you get some weird questions, you're like, wow, that is really kind of weird. Maybe it's one of the questions they're testing out. Don't let it throw you off. Keep going. So what I'd like to do now is just launch another poll and ask you these questions. What are some study strategies that might help you succeed in the exam? Okay, so focus your study time on topics you're already familiar with. Take as many practice tests as possible, or C, read as many books on diabetes as you possibly can, or is it D, develop a study plan and block of study time, or is it E, you can choose more than one, teach the content to someone else. Okay, so you want to choose the right answer on your screen. There's like a little radio bullet that you can click on to choose the right answer. Okay, thank you everyone for voting. I'm going to go ahead and close this and share it with all of you. So the first one is focus your study time on topics you're already comfortable with. So I would say that's what we all want to do. We want to, you know, review what we know. Okay, don't review what you know. Review what you don't know. Like review the stuff that is really hard for you. For example, I mostly work with adults with diabetes, you know, during my career. And so learning about women during pregnancy was really a challenge for me. But then I had started reading about, you know, diabetes and women, diabetes and pregnancy, and I really started loving it. So focus your time on topics you're least familiar with. Do you want to grow and expand your knowledge base? So B, let's go to B. So A, I would not do that. I'd focus on stuff I'm unfamiliar with. B, take as many practice tests as possible. Yes, yes, yes. You want to take as many practice exams as possible. I'll be talking about that in a little while where you can find those. C, read as many books on diabetes as possible. Okay, only 11% of you chose that. I'm going to share this. Sorry, guys. Only 11% of you chose that, and that's great because you don't want to overwhelm yourself with information. It gets too big and you just don't know even where to start or go. So I'm going to help you focus on what books and resources you should be reading. And that's not from me. Well, it is partly from me from taking the exam and being a diabetes educator for so long. But it's also from the NCBDE, what they recommend. So we're going to focus in on the key books and resources that are going to help us, because we know we have limited time. I know most of you are working, you have family, you have other obligations, so we're trying to squeeze a study time in the best we can. D, develop a study plan and block off study time. Excellent idea. We should all be doing that. Get your calendar books and say, these are the times I'm going to study, and you hide yourself away. You go to the library. You go to a coffee house where you don't know people. Don't go to a coffee house where you know everybody in the neighborhood. You'll never get any studying done. So you know what I'm saying. You need to sequester yourself and just focus your study time. And then teach the content to someone else. Great idea. When I teach content, I really improve my knowledge of something, because I have to research it, I have to articulate it, and then it makes these paths in my brain where I have to, through the language and the memory path, where I have to think about what I'm going to say, and it stays in there so I can access the information later. So the more you can teach, the better. If you want to choose a subject you're really least comfortable with and teach about it, you will overcome your uncomfortability. You'll become very knowledgeable about it. Okay, I'm going to ask you one more question. You know what? I'm going to keep going. I'll ask you a question in a minute. Okay, so the exam content, there's 60 questions on assessment. Assessment is very important. It's when we sit across from that patient and we're trying to figure out their life experience. Remember we were talking about that? Their expectations, their goals, their health history. It's so critical. If we don't do a good assessment, we don't know where to go next. So this assessment is 60 points of the exam. It's a lot of points. We're going to look at medical, psychosocial, economic, and health status. How are they doing their diabetes currently? Are they checking their blood sugars? Are they taking their meds? You know, are they just have a prescription they've never filled because they don't understand the medications? Or are they checking their blood sugars and they don't even know what it means? Very important part of what we do. 60 questions dedicated to that. Now, the intervention part's even bigger, about 89 questions. This is after our assessment, we're going to work with that patient to develop diabetes self-management goals. So we're going to collaborate not only with the patient, but the family, caregiver, and health team. And then we're going to look at principles of diabetes care. This is where we're going to understand what their risks are, what their lifestyle is, what their values are, and work with them to develop behavioral learning goals. And we're going to bring the science together with where the patient is at. And collaboratively, we're going to set forth those goals. We're going to evaluate, revise, and document. So we need to write down what we're going to do, share it with the providers, and then we're going to have to find a time for follow-up and referral as needed. Intervention, very important. This is where medications, medical nutrition therapy, exercise, all of those come in, the foundations of diabetes care. And so this is within that section. 26 questions on education and program standards. What are the national standards for diabetes self-management education? What about our clinical practice? So we need to be familiar with the inpatient and outpatient standards for American Diabetes Association and American Association of Clinical Endocrinology. I have articles and links to articles on my website for what you need to be familiar with for these. So we need to not only know how to help patients shift behavior and support them in shifting behavior. We can't, of course, make anybody change behavior, but we're going to help support them make changes. And we need to be familiar with assessment. We also need to be familiar with clinical guidelines. So focus on clinical guidelines, not in your practice, but the national ones. Your practice might have very specific clinical guidelines and goals. That's great. Know those for your job setting, of course, but you want to be familiar with the national guidelines by ADA, and AACE. Okay, this is so wordy. This breaks every PowerPoint rule. I apologize, but I thought it was really important. This is from the NCBDE, just posted on Saturday. National Credentialing Board for Diabetes Educator, one of the directors there said, I hope you don't mind me posting this on LinkedIn, but she goes, here's some study tips for the exam. I'm like, this is great. I want to share this with all of you. So, exam questions are created using any number of resources, and each question has to be tied directly to a task on the exam content outline. So on our website, we have an outline of the exam content. look at that exam content and you could use it as a checklist. Do I know this content or do I need to study this area more? It's one page of content and you can take a look at that. Oh, here's another idea from her. Think outside your area of practice or population when reviewing the exam content outline, for example. If you work with adult population, think about peds or gestational. Or if you mainly work with type 1, think about type 2. Aha! So again, special population is very important. If I'm mostly working with adults, I better become more familiar with type 1. And actually, when I'm looking through the content, I want to really identify where my strengths are and where I need to study more. Then look for resources that will help you address your areas of weakness. I love this. So what she's saying is, do a self-assessment, find out where your strong areas are, where you need to learn more, and based on where you need to learn more, study, get CEs, you know, read about it. So this is a really excellent way to hone in your study time. The exam handbook has information about preparing for the exam, including the exam content outline, which I've talked about. Info on preparing for the exam can be found on page 14 of the handbook, and sample questions are there too. So hope that helps, and best of luck. Wow, that's from Cheryl from the NCBDE. So thank you very much for sharing that with us. So you can see they're on our side. The National Credentialing Board for Diabetes Educators wants us to succeed, which is a great feeling. They're not out there to trick us or give hard questions. They're out there to make sure that we have the skills and knowledge necessary to provide great diabetes education, which I really appreciate. Okay, this is right from my website. Under the Resources tab at my website, under Level 3, Getting Ready for CDE, I put in here articles to review. These are the articles that are referred to by the NCBDE. These are articles I would read and know, anything with the asterisk by it, right on my website. Standards of Care, ADA, ACE, Comprehensive Diabetes Management Algorithm, and this is What Do Diabetes Educators Do? Here's the exam content outline. Here's screening and diagnosis for diabetes. All very important. So these are articles you automatically want to start reading right now. Get your highlighter out and start, you know, just highlighting key points. Go to your least familiar. And these are the books that are very helpful for people who are studying the Art and Science Diabetes Self-Management Desk Reference. This is 800 pages of great information. This is a review guide which a lot of people use to hone in on what should I study in particular, because this book, not only the review guide has 200 questions in the book, there's another 200 computer-based through AADE. And we sell these on our website. We have great prices. We want to be a resource for you. But you can purchase these, and these two are really a nice complement for each other. And this big of desk reference you'll use for years to come. It has so much great information on it. The other thing I want to invite you to is one of our live web course, our live courses. We're providing a 3-day course in Carmel, April 8th through 10th, where there's a team of three of us, and we teach for 3 days straight with all of you on getting ready for the diabetes education exam. And of course, we also bring in all of our experience and share that with you. So it's more than just getting ready for the exam. It's like, wow, how do we become the best diabetes educators possible? If you can't make it in Carmel, we're going to be in San Diego in September. We only choose beautiful places for our courses. I mean, I always choose them by the ocean and these beautiful locations where you can bring your family and, you know, just really enjoy the environment too. The other thing we just started doing in the fall of 2014 is offering the CDE boot camp. So we're offering it in the spring also, starting April 1st. Now, what is a boot camp? Well, there's 7 online courses, and these courses are going to start April 1st, and we meet twice a week, and I just go over the content of the exam. I use the outline as my guide, so we go over content you need to be familiar with, and we do a ton of sample questions. A lot of sample questions, I do them live and on the air, so you can see if you choose the wrong answer, kind of how to reshape your thinking and approach to the question so you can be ready for the exam. The results are in. The CDE boot campers are passing. So people who came to our boot camp, they're checking in with us and letting us know how they did on the exam. And if you want to get inspired, go click on that link in your PDF handout, and you'll see all the people who have passed. It's just amazing. And there's people of all ages and all backgrounds who are passing the exam, and their stories are really just terrific. Okay, so I want to ask you another poll question. Now I'm ready for the next poll question. What are some of the underlying themes of this CDE exam?
No webinar, thank you.
Is it A, CDEs motivate people to change behavior? Or is it B, CDEs empower patients to improve diabetes self-management? You can choose more than one. Is it C, consider the individual needs goals, etc.? Is it D, help all people with diabetes achieve an A1C less than 7%? Or is it E, CDEs collaborate and provide ongoing support and resources? So you can choose more than one. Oh, it doesn't let you choose more than one. Oh, okay. Well, if it only allows one choice, sorry about that, then just choose the answer that you think is best. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. Thank you, everyone, for voting. I appreciate it. And so if you chose A, I'm going to share this with you, only 2% of you chose A. Actually, CDEs can't really motivate people to change behavior. So this is a tricky question. It's tricky wording. It's really only the patient that can motivate themselves. So that's a little bit of a hair splicing. I totally get that. But we can't make anybody do anything. That's the bottom line here. It's the patient who has to find the motivation. We are going to do B, empower our patients to improve their diabetes self-management. That's the main focus. We're going to empower them. We're going to share information with them so they can make those changes. And also C is a correct answer. We're going to definitely need to consider individuals' needs, their goals, and their history of diabetes. So B and C definitely are correct. D, help all people with diabetes achieve A1C less than 7? No, that's not possible. So you guys didn't choose that, which is really great. Nobody chose that. And then E, yes, CDEs collaborate and provide ongoing care and education. Yes. So B, C, and E are all correct. And that is very important to kind of keep in mind when you're sitting for the exam, that all of these are kind of the underpinnings of what diabetes educators are all about and what we're trying to work toward. So thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, so taking the test, let's get to some test-taking strategies, questions, answers, and pitfalls. Okay, so reading too fast. Make sure that you all really read the question carefully. And there's something really important I have listed here, the key intent of the question. What are they really trying to get toward? What is the key intent? What is the stem? You really want to make sure you understand the question. I'm saying the same thing about five different ways, but it's so important because they're going to give you a lot of extra words. So what is the key intent? And then you want to choose the right answer. What I have here is choosing a good answer, but not the right answer. So when I mean a good answer in quotes, is a juicy answer. They're going to give you juicy answers that you want to choose. They're just going to tempt you. You're going to want to choose that answer. It seems like it should be right. But when you look to see, does it really match the key intent of the question? It doesn't. So make sure you look for the right answer, not the juicy answer. That's really so important. Always look for words like this. Always, never, most, probably, usually. They're going to inform you about whether or not the answer is right, and they're going to help be very important to recognize in a question. I'll get to that more later. Choosing an answer you don't understand because the others seem too easy. No. Sometimes they might have long-winded answers that are very complex. That's a juicy answer, too. It's not, but it's not right. So just choose the right answer. And you want to focus on empowerment. So we are diabetes educators. What if you're a nurse practitioner or a PA, or what if you do more medical management? Take that hat off and put on your education hat. We're not focusing on the medical need. We're really focusing on the behavior change, psychosocial needs. We're not doing medical management. We're diabetes educators. So important to keep your education hat on. So they're going to tempt you with medical-related answers, but we want to focus on we're helping empower patients to change behavior. Another really important thing, keep in mind the patient's characteristics. They're going to give you information about the patient. They're going to give you vignettes. Carry that with you as you look at the vignette questions. Very, very important. We support our patient's effort toward behavior change. That's what we're all about. Okay, thinking pitfalls. Imagining an answer is right. Oh, no, here it is. Imagining a right answer. So you read the question, you go, I know the answer, and you have that answer in your head. And then when you look at the possible choices, it's not there. It throws you off. Don't worry about it. You know, answers are going to pop up in your head. You're going to say, I'll consider that, but let me see what's available. And then you look at each of the answers listed and choose the best one. Try not to overthink. We hear this some feedback a lot from people after they take it. They just overthink. They put their own patients into the situation. They add words or they add other information. Don't add anything to the question. Just use what's there at hand. Using the goals in your clinical setting. Okay, don't do that. So you might have goals in your clinical setting. Maybe you work for Sweet Success, or maybe you work at a peds endo, or maybe you work in a special medical practice or group. Okay, they have their own particular goals, but the ADA goals is what you want to study. The ADA and AACE goals are the ones you want to be familiar with. Focus on national goals. Very, very important. So take a practice test. Learn how to work questions. Weed through the details. They're going to give you, I'm just telling you guys, a lot of information. So you have to figure out what's really relevant to this question and what is really not that relevant. Make sure you really understand the key intent of the question. Find the stem. We're going to practice them. Read all the answers. You guys remember this, I know, from test taking, but it's good to review. Eliminate wrong answers. Find the stem. Read all the options, eliminate wrong answers, and this is the most important bullet point on my whole presentation, select the best option, best option. So you might go, wow, these two seem right, okay, but there's always a best option. So you have to really look, key intent, best option, key intent, best option. That's going to be your mantra during the exam. So answers with the following words are usually incorrect. If an answer has the word always, never, all, none, only, must, and completely, it's probably not right because it doesn't allow for human behavior, right? We're never always or never. We're always in the gray zone. Answers with the following words are usually correct. I put this green. See green? Red. Correct. Seldom, most, generally, tend to, probably, usually. It allows for the human condition. So that's going to give you clues in the answers. Getting to the right answer. Don't leave anything blank. Look for clues in the question. Don't get lured in by juicy answers. These are great bullet points. Avoid imposing your life experience into the questions and the answer. Don't bring in your clinical practice. Just look at what you have. Keep breathing. Oh, my gosh, you're going to get tense. You're not going to breathe, and then your brain's not going to get enough oxygenation. Get up and move. Stretch. Stand up. Bend over. Do mental gymnastics. I don't care. You can get up and move. It's not against the rules. And that's going to really help you to de-stress and be calm. And then if there's a math problem, work it out on scratch paper. Really important, too. Okay, there's three types of questions. Recall, just facts, principles, procedures. Those are all straightforward. There's applications that you have to, like we talked about earlier, there's going to be some piece of knowledge you have to apply to a clinical setting. And then the most complex are analysis, which is an integration or synthesis of a variety of concepts or elements. So lots of different variables. It's going to really test your knowledge of diabetes in a very in-depth way. So of all the questions, there's probably most recall and application. There's least you know, Lisa, the less questions on analysis, but they're there. So take your time on those. So what I'd like to do is launch into a sample question one. Now, I rewrote this. It's different than your handout because I wanted to show you what I mean about, you know, getting through the weeds, figuring out what's relevant, what's not relevant, what is the key intent. So I purposely added a lot of words to this question, so you'll see it's different than your handout. Let's read it together. A patient is admitted to the hospital with elevated glucose levels with a strong family history of diabetes. She has started on fluid replacement and is placed on a clear liquid diet. Her father is in the room and very concerned about her. Which of the following would suggest a diagnosis of new onset type 1 versus type 2 diabetes?
Okay,
so just think about what is the key intent of this question. What are they really trying to get at? You can underline it or, you know, just say it out loud to yourself. Yes, you're right. They want to know type 1 versus type 2. You see all the unrelated information they gave you in the top? They're going to do that a lot. Just be ready for that. So you need to sift through a lot of details to get to the key intent. And the key intent here is type 1 versus type 2. Okay, so let's go down here to A, hyperglycemia. So does hyperglycemia differentiate type 1 from type 2? Not really. Type 1s can become hyperglycemic, and so can type 2. So that doesn't help us differentiate between the two. So we're going to say wrong answer. Okay, wrong. B, polyuria. What is polyuria? Going to the bathroom a lot. Does type 1 get that? Oh, yeah. Does type 2? Okay, so you might think to yourself, well, not every type 2 gets polyuria. We don't care about that because they could get polyuria. That's what matters. Both type 1 and type 2 can go to the bathroom a lot as a sign of diabetes. So that does not differentiate. Wrong answer. Ketosis. What is ketosis? We need to know what that means. That means you're burning fat for fuel because you don't make enough insulin. Does that happen with type 1? Yeah, diabetes, ketoacidosis. Does it happen with type 2? Not really, very rarely. Ketosis truly is a differentiating factor between type 1 and type 2, and in many situations, that's what we use. We do urine ketones, and we'll look at their pH level to see how much blood ketones are in there, because it makes your blood acid. So ketosis looks like the right answer. We're keeping that as a hopeful one. Let's go on to D to make sure. Polydipsia, so thirsty. Do type 1s get thirsty? Yeah. Do type 2s? Yeah, they can too. So clearly C is the right answer. So I hope you all chose that. And if you didn't, here's the deal. This is why you take practice tests, so that if you don't get it right, you just write it, say in your mind, oh, I need to learn more about pathophysiology of diabetes. I'm going to study that particular concept. You see what I'm saying? So this gives you information not about, you know, whether you're bad or good, it just gives you information that, oh, these are areas I need to study more. That's how I want you to interpret this, okay? Let's go on to our next one. MJ has type 1 diabetes and wants to know the possible complications that can result from hyperglycemia during the first trimester of pregnancy. Which of the following complications can result from first trimester hyperglycemia? So, again, we need to get to the key intent of this. Really, the key intent is in the last sentence. Which of the following complications can result from first trimester hyperglycemia? And I'm going to go ahead and launch this poll so you all can take a minute to vote. Is it macrosomia? Is it vascular defects? Is it C, shoulder dystocia? Or is it D, spina bifida? So take a minute.
Now, is she actually using it so often? Really? Every 4 hours? Okay. Okay. So then.
All right, so I see you guys are having trouble hearing. Maybe everybody, can you mute your phones if you haven't done that already? That'll be great.
Okay, so
someone is talking over you about patients.
Let me double up on the dose. Double up on the amount.
Yeah, so this is so interesting. If you could all mute your phones, because I'm going to tell you, I'm in a sound booth, so I have no sound where I'm sitting. It's completely silent where I'm at. So it must be someone out there. So if you can mute your phones, that'll be so great. And I'll do one more thing. Hang on.
Did you tell them it's urgent? Because it's very hard for me to write a new prescription. They're really unhappy there. when they do that, they ask me that everybody refills. But if you're completely out, I'll do that now. But please, refill it, you know, the regular way, because I get in trouble too. Okay? But I'll send the prescription. You're going to, huh? In the chat.
Okay, thanks everybody. So we have 78%. She is still talking.
Why? Do you know?
Oh boy. So if anybody is out there, that could.
Only one pill left.
If you can mute your phone, we'd really appreciate it.
30 pills, so
okay. I'm gonna keep going. Is she still talking? It's 12:20. Melanie, thanks you guys. You are really helping me to hopefully get this figured out. Let me just look at audio. Oh, thanks, Linda. Linda says she feels bad for me. Thanks, Linda. I appreciate it. Think flowers. I'm going to think flowers. That's a good idea. Okay, I'm just going to have to keep going. You know what? If it comes out, when the recording comes out, you can hear the extraneous noise. I'll just hold this session again. So if you could stick in here with me, I really appreciate it. And hopefully you can all put your phones on mute, and that would be so, so terrific. Okay, she's not talking now. Yes, thank you. All right, we'll go over this together then. Okay, polls. So let me share this poll. So 33% of you chose macrosomia. So let me just tell you, A is not the right answer, because macrosomia means a big baby. And big babies usually happen with gestational diabetes. So gestational diabetes is usually discovered later in pregnancies, and the babies get really big, or they can if the blood sugars aren't controlled. So that is not the correct answer. We're looking at what can happen during first trimester. So this is when the fetus is exposed to hyperglycemia in the first 3 months. So you want to think back, what is developing during the first 3 months of the baby's gestation? And that's a very important question. So it's early exposure to hyperglycemia by the fetus during the first 3 months. Okay, vascular defects, 42% of you chose that. That is a juicy answer, but it is not the best answer, and it's not the right answer. So let's keep going. So that is not correct. So how would you learn more about this topic? You'd have to learn about, you know, read about diabetes and pregnancy. And we do have a whole webcast on diabetes and pregnancy that you could take a look at. Or you could get the Art and Science Review Guide and take a look at diabetes and pregnancy in there. Very, very informative. Shoulder dystocia, 2% of you chose that. That means when the baby's being born, the shoulder gets dislocated. So that is not the right answer. But the right answer, 22% of you chose that, is spina bifida. So neurological development can be affected when there's hyperglycemia in the first trimester. The first trimester is when organogenesis takes place, when the baby's organs are forming, so they're very vulnerable to hyperglycemia. That's why we really want to get blood sugars to target right away when a woman discovers that she's pregnant and has diabetes. Very, very important. As a matter of fact, if the woman already has diabetes, we're going to work hard with her to make sure that before she becomes pregnant, her blood sugars are under excellent control so that the fetus is not exposed to hyperglycemia early in the development. Okay, so if you didn't get that question right, you're not going to beat yourself up. You're just going to say, hey, I need to study that topic more. You know, I'm not familiar with diabetes and pregnancy. It's not my area of specialty. I'm going to go study it. Let's take a look at another vignette-style question. We have a read the following vignette to answer the next three questions. They're going to be saying that to you a lot. A 47-year-old man with newly diagnosed type 2 diabetes. Here's what else we know about him. He's married with two teenagers. He's a professor. He's obese. He started on metformin 500 milligrams twice a day. And his father died of kidney failure secondary to diabetes. So we're going to keep that all in mind with the next question. Given what you know about this patient, what emotions would you expect him to express? Let me launch this poll. Would you expect fear of hypoglycemia? A, reluctance to start insulin? B, C, panic disorder? Or D, fear of complications? I'm just going to say, somebody asked me what was the answer for the last question. And it was spina bifida was the correct answer for the last question. D. Mm-hmm. Okay, but now we're on this one. So given what you know about this patient from the vignette, what emotions would you expect him to express? We're going to choose the best answer. What's the key intent of this question? It's right there. So choosing the best answer based on the vignette. Okay, somebody wants me to repeat the question. So what emotions would you expect him to express based on that vignette? He's a professor and his dad had complications of diabetes. What emotions? So let's go ahead and close this and share this with you. So nobody chose fear of hypoglycemia. Great job, because that's not the issue. He doesn't talk about his dad didn't experience hypo, or this patient isn't even at risk for hypo because he's on metformin. So nobody chose that. Great job. C, reluctance to start insulin. Okay, so let's just think about that for a minute. Some of you chose that, and that is not the right answer. Did I say C? I meant to say B. So B, reluctance to start insulin. His father wasn't on insulin. He never talks in the vignette about hating needles. He doesn't talk about, I never want to start insulin no matter what. It's never brought up or referenced to. So even though it may be true that patients in general don't want to start on insulin, there was nothing in this vignette that led us in that direction. So B is not the right answer. C, panic disorder. Okay, that could, it could happen. He might have panic disorder, but it's never mentioned. He doesn't say he has high anxiety. He has a history of panic disorder. We don't hear anything about panic disorder. So that is not true. That is not the correct answer. So you just want to use what's in the vignette to answer the question and then choose the best answer. So 92% of you chose the right answer, fear of complications. So great job, everybody. Great job. It makes sense. His dad had complications of diabetes, so of course he's fearful about it. And so we want to talk about that and acknowledge it and see if we can't remind him that having diabetes doesn't lead to complications. Uncontrolled diabetes leads to complications. But if you manage it, you can prevent complications. So we need to reassure our patients and give them the science behind it. Okay, so we're still on this guy. 47-year-old, newly diagnosed type 2, married with teenagers, professor, obese, on metformin. His dad died of kidney failure. Okay, so we want to ask this question. What is most likely, so this is very important, most likely to be a potential barrier to lifestyle change? I'm going to launch this poll. Is it difficulty exercising due to obesity? Is it excessive alcohol intake, B? Is it teenage children, or is it D, working long hours? Okay. So let's what is the best answer? And please consider the information the vignette gives you. That's very important. Don't read into anything, just the information that we have at hand. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share it with you. All right, so 52% of you said difficulty exercising due to obesity. Is it a fact that it's difficult to exercise when you're obese? It is. That's a known fact. We know that, and we know he's obese. For people who are obese, Their extra body weight makes movement more difficult, and many times they're shy to exercise because they feel self-conscious about their body weight. So A seems like the right answer, but we have to consider all of them. Let's keep going. Excessive alcohol intake, nobody chose that. Great job, team, because it never talks about him drinking a lot, right? So that's not even an issue. C, teenage children, 6% of you chose that. He does have teenage children, but it doesn't say in the vignette, oh, his teenage children are causing him a lot of trouble, or he has to go to all their soccer games, or he's driving them everywhere. It doesn't talk about any of that. So even though it's a juicy answer, it is not right. D, long work hours. Okay, that is another very juicy answer. And he is a professor. So, but he could be a really lazy professor. He could be a part-time professor. He could be on sabbatical. It never says in the question or in the vignette that he works long hours. It never alludes to that. It doesn't say he's, you know, overworked, nothing like that. So that, if you chose D, just know that you might be at risk for reading into questions. So if you chose that, it gives you a strong signal. Only look at what the question offers. Only use the information in the vignette. Don't add any other information to it. Okay, so that's really, really important. Okay, let's go on to the next one. The same patient requests information about healthy eating. Which meal planning approach best suits this individual until he can see a registered dietitian? Okay, we're using the word best again. They do this a lot. Which meal planning approach best suits him until he can see a registered dietitian? Is it A, give him a 1,200 calorie exchange plan? Is it B, avoid all concentrated sweets? Is it C, eat 3 meals a day with snacks in between? Or is it D, healthy eating based on my plate method? All right. Thanks for voting, everybody. I just want to say it's 12:30. We have about 10 more minutes, and we're going to do a few more sample test questions. So if you can stay, great. That would be terrific. But if you need to go, I understand, and this will be recorded and posted, so you can always listen to the entire webcast again, or you could scroll through and just listen to the last 10 minutes if you have to, you know, get back to patients. But it's just, I want to make sure I go over this content. It's so important. So thank you for your patience and understanding and joining us. Let me go ahead and close this poll. So we're trying to figure out what meal planning approach best suits this patient until he can see a registered dietitian. So this is like a stopgap until he can see the RD. What are we going to provide them with? So nobody chose a 1,200 calorie exchange plan. Great job, you guys, because that's old school. We don't do that anymore, and that's not individualized for the patient. Okay, 16% of you chose B. Now, I want to give you one reason why B is wrong. It has the word all in it. So anytime you see an answer with the word all, it's usually wrong. And this answer is wrong, too, because the American Diabetes Association says sugar can be incorporated into the meal plan as long as it's counted as part of the carbohydrates. So this is not the right answer either. So how would you know that? Well, you need to be familiar with the medical nutrition therapy guidelines set forth by the ADA, and those are incorporated into the standards of care. And I'm also going to post them on our website under resources to read. But also, it's just not right information. Okay, C, eat 3 meals a day with snacks in between. That is really not recommended anymore. Patients were gaining weight doing that strategy. But the best answer is D, healthy eating based on my plate method. So we have to look for what's the best option given these four choices. And D is the best option, and 82% of you chose that. So great job, team. All right, let's keep going. And, of course, seeing a dietitian is so important because dietitians are so effective at medical nutrition therapy. If a patient with type 1 sees a dietitian, they lower their A1C by 1 percentage point. And with type 2s, they can lower A1Cs 2 percentage points. So dietitians are critical in the success of patients living with diabetes. Okay, sample question 3. Metformin is an anti-diabetic agent different than that of sulfonylurea drugs. Some features of the drug are that it, A, I'm going to go ahead and launch the poll. stimulates insulin secretion and increases hepatic glucose production? Or B, does it cause hypoglycemia? C, does it lower hyperglycemia in people with diabetes, but does not lower blood glucose levels in people without? Or D, does it result in weight gain and increase in plasma glucose level? So what's the best answer? Okay, while you're looking at this, Jessica has a great question. Will the new 2015 diabetes standards be on the spring 2015 test? So I would say always study the most recent standards. Know the recent standards. And they will not ask questions about the old standards. So they will not include old standards in the questions for 2015. So they'll just avoid that area until they update the test questions. And then how long before you get the test results? That day. So once you take the exam, you get the results. Okay. So I'm going to get back. I saw there's some other questions being posted. So what I'll do is I'll save those questions for after the program so you all can get back to your jobs. And then if you can stay, I'm so happy to answer all of your questions. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll because most of you have voted. So how is metformin different than that of sulfonylurea drugs? What are some of its features? So what is the key intent of this question? What are the features of metformin? That's what it's really trying to ask, okay? So the first one says stimulates insulin secretion and increases hepatic glucose production. Is that the right answer? No, it's not. Because you just need to know that metformin actually decreases hepatic glucose production. So you might say to me, how do I know about these meds? Well, on our website, we have the diabetes medication pocket cards and insulin and injectables cards that you can download and print. Those are great study tools. So you can download those and start memorizing the class of medication, its main action, and what are its side effects and considerations. You want to be familiar with what these drugs do and the side effects that we need to share with our patients. Very, very important. Okay, so this is a wrong answer. Anyways, no medication for diabetes would increase hepatic glucose production. That means blood sugars go up because the liver is releasing sugar. So read the question carefully, and even if you don't know what metformin does, you could tell this was a wrong answer by the second half because no diabetes medication would do that. A is wrong. Okay, B, causes hypoglycemia. No, it doesn't cause hypoglycemia. Metformin, that's not its side effect. So you just need to know that. C, so 56% of you chose C. Let's see if it's correct. Lowers hyperglycemia in persons with diabetes, but does not lower blood glucose level in people without diabetes. Okay, this is weird. So you're saying, yeah, it's right. It does lower blood sugars in people with diabetes. You're not sure about the second half. It seems logical, but you know for sure that's what it does. It lowers blood sugar. So C looks like the right answer, but let's go to D. Results in weight gain and increase in plasma glucose level. Again, no diabetes pill would increase plasma glucose level. So we know A and D are wrong just because of the way the questions are written. C, we'd have to know that metformin does not cause hypo. But that's the wrong answer. B is the wrong answer. But C, we do know, is the correct answer. So now by process of elimination, we've got to the right answer, and that is C. I hope that was helpful because that's – you want to – don't get overwhelmed by all the big words and hepatic glucose production and all that. Just translate it to English and so that you can really take a good look at the question. Okay. This is the last question. A person with type 2 diabetes is on twice daily dose of basal bolus insulin and complains of waking up with morning headaches. If the fasting capillary glucose is 291, this person should be advised to do what? Should they increase their evening dose of basal insulin? Should they increase their morning dose of bolus insulin? Should they check 3 a.m. blood glucose, or should they just eliminate that bedtime snack? So just think of the key intent of the question, and then what would be the best answer? Oh, where are the poll questions? Thank you. Here are the poll questions. Yes, you do vote. You guys are helping me a lot today. I appreciate it. It's Monday, right? I'll just blame it on being Monday. Actually, there's a lot of, you know, back-end technology I'm trying to manage while I'm teaching. So thanks for your patience. What is the key intent of this question? Blood sugar is 291. What should we do? How can we help fix this? But we have to consider two things. They're complaining of waking up with morning headaches, and their fasting blood sugars are 291. Those are two things we must consider. And I'll just say basal bolus insulin means they're on long-acting plus short-acting insulin. So we need to know what that means too. And on my pocket cards, I've listed out which insulins are basal and which are bolus. Okay, 83% of you have voted, so I'm going to go ahead and close this, and I'm going to share the results. So let me just walk you through this. This is a more complicated question because you need to know what is the significance of morning headaches. Morning headaches actually indicate that people are getting low blood sugar. It indicates morning headaches indicate nocturnal hypoglycemia. That's very important to know for our patients, you know, in real life too. If a patient comes in and they are getting morning headaches, I'm going to see if they're getting low in the middle of the night. And then I'm going to look at their fasting blood sugar. His is high. Why is his fasting blood sugar high? Well, I'm going to tell you what I think is happening. He's going low in the middle of the night, and then he's releasing all those stress hormones like adrenaline and cortisol and growth hormone to crank his blood sugars up. He has rebound hyperglycemia. How would I verify this? Of all these answers, how would I see if he actually has rebound hypoglycemia, rebound hyperglycemia? By C, checking 3 a.m. blood glucose. So let's just, this is right now looking like my best answer, but I'm going to go through A. So if you increase the evening dose of basal insulin, that will get his morning blood sugar down, but it might even intensify his nocturnal hypoglycemia. So that would not be the right answer. This morning headache is very important. A is wrong. B, increase morning dose of bolus insulin. Only 2% of you chose that. Good job. Because you're like, okay, he's high in the morning. I'll give him more morning insulin. But no, we have to fix it the night before. B is not the right answer. Some of you chose D, eliminate bedtime snack. Well, you're thinking he's high in the morning. He's eating too much at night. But that is not the culprit. The culprit is probably too much insulin at bedtime, making him go too low and causing rebound hyperglycemia. So the best answer is here. Check a 3 a.m. blood glucose. It doesn't say reduce nighttime insulin. We can't choose that. So the next best answer is C. Check 3 a.m. blood glucose. If you didn't get that right, it's okay. It just tells you you need more study time on medications, side effects, and pattern management. And so that's the information you take from this if you don't get the questions right. But that's why taking a lot of different tests is so important, so you get information about where your knowledge gaps are and where to spend your time studying. So that kind of wraps up our sample test questions. I do offer 100 test question practice exam questions on my CDE webinar, which is preparing for the CDE in our online university, and I'll send you an email about that. And also we have our boot camp, which I'll talk about in a minute. But study habits. Find your best time of day to study. Determine your learning style. Do you like listening? Do you want to read? Do you need to move and go to workshops and demonstrations? Do you like live presentations? Have a study space. Have a study plan. Schedule your time. Study groups can be very effective if they're run well. Some study groups tend to turn into social gathering time. I know, I've been in those, and they're a lot of fun, but you want to really get to the heart of the matter. Have an agenda. Set up the rules. Everyone does their share and commits to attend. With my first CDE exam, I did participate in a study group, and it gave me a lot of moral support and decreased my test anxiety. And each of us had to come to the study group with 10 sample questions from a particular topic. So we had to learn that topic and write questions about it. When you're thinking about how to spend your study time, it's limited. So review of what you know, that's only 30%. Learning new materials, that's where you want to spend your time. You want to go to maybe CDE preparation courses, get flashcards, sample tests, teach to someone else, and bring your study stuff with you when you're driving and you get stuck in traffic or, well, maybe not while you're driving exactly, but if you have to go to an appointment and wait, just have it ready in case you have that free moment. Knowledge equals confidence. The more you know, the better you're going to do. The more confident you are, the less anxiety you have at the exam. So as your knowledge expands, so does your confidence. So the more you study, the more confident you become. And if you struggle with test anxiety, really talking gently to ourselves and use your first name. Studies show that when we talk to ourselves with our first name, like, you know, Beverly, you've been studying really hard for this. You're ready for this exam. By coaching ourselves gently and positively and helping really evaluate where we're strong at and where we need to study more, we're more likely to succeed. So talk kindly and gently to yourself. Deep breathe. Take practice exams. Rest well the night before. Know how to get to the test site. Arrive early and know your stuff. And again, I'm just going to go over some resources that are available that can help you. You can go to look at these books and review guides. You can come to live courses. And then the boot camp, somebody was asking about the boot camp. What is that all about? Well, what we do is we start April 1st. It's a series of 7 live webcasts. And so we just start going over very quickly and intensely the main concepts to be familiar with on the exam, and we integrate a lot of poll questions, and they're hard poll questions. So they're sample test questions we do live so we can dissect them together and figure out how to get to the right answer. So we don't start till April 1st, and in the meantime, if you want to get ready for the boot camp, you can either come to attend our online courses, level 1 and level 2, or come to our live course. So that would be a way to prepare for it, and then by the time the spring boot camp comes around, you're ready. You're ready to dive in and really just focus on the exam. And like I said, if you can go to our CDE exam boot camp success page, you're going to be really impressed with the people who've attended that and passed, and what the stories they tell are so inspiring. Oh, here's one of them. This is Alana, and Alana took the CDE boot camp, and she said the exam was even harder than I expected. Thanks for your tips on passing, and she's going to recommend our courses to other people, of course, not patients, other healthcare professionals. But to look at that page of all the success stories, you can, you know, click on that link. Thank you so much for attending. You are going to do great. Thank you for bearing through it on with the technical difficulties. We're going to record this, and I'll listen to the recording. If there's a lot of background noise, we'll re-record it. But I really appreciate your participation in the polls, and I appreciate your efforts to become a certified diabetes educator. We really do need diabetes educators in this country. There's an epidemic of diabetes and prediabetes. So your participation in slowing down this epidemic and helping people stay healthier is very appreciated. I'm going to stop recording, but I will stay for any additional questions. So this is Beverly Tomasian signing off.